May it please the court, counsel, I'm Gary Cohen, registration number 7612, on behalf of the appellants. This case involves a textbook case of mootness as a result of subsequent events, and also a textbook case of why the Van Scott Supreme, Colorado Supreme Court, quoted from the United States Supreme Court in Munsingware, that it is the duty of the appellate court to vacate the judgment below when the case is mooted on appeal. This case, which is a fraudulent transfer case, arises from an underlying case in which Equity Secured Funds, or ESF, alleged that the McKennas owed ESF money. A jury verdict was entered in favor of ESF, including punitive damages, and this case was tried before the court based on the fact that that judgment existed and was valid. It turns out that this court, in the underlying case, reversed in totality the monetary judgments entered in favor of ESF against McKenna. So there was no debt. McKenna did not owe any money to ESF.
Pardon me for interrupting, counsel. If yes. I recall the prior division's opinion, it did state, though, that the Roxbury properties had to be returned. Is that so?
Yes. But those,
I understand, but I'm just wondering if that's so, and has that occurred?
It is so. The Court of Appeals, this court, remanded it to the trial court, and ESF has taken no action on the remand. So there are issues in that case because title to the property was in the name of McKenna Development Company, Inc., which was a different entity from the defendant in the other case, McKenna Development Company, a limited liability company. So the remand had to address those issues, and that hasn't occurred yet. But that's not a monetary judgment against the McKennas.
And your position, obviously, is to have a CUFTA claim, you have to have a monetary judgment that's enforceable.
Yes, and those judgments were against entities. McKenna Development Company, a limited liability company, not against...
But there was one claim, one judgment against Mr. McKenna personally, was there not?
Not that survived.
Oh, right, okay. Originally, there was a judgment against an entity and Mr. McKenna personally, and both of those judgments were reversed.
Right, there were four judgments, right. Actually, and all four of those were reversed.
Right.
And so, even though there was an allegation, and this case was tried, in the underlying case, there was an allegation, there was a judgment, this case was tried based upon the validity of that underlying judgment. Now, if in 2009, May 2009, the trial court in the underlying case had entered the order correctly, there would have been no judgment. There would have been no debt from the McKennas to ESF, and ESF would not have been a creditor. So this whole case wouldn't have even gone forward. However, the McKennas did not post a supersedious bond, so the trial court decided to go forward. Subsequent events, in fact, after the notice of appeal was filed in this case, show that the facts, which were relied upon by the trial court, that there was a debt, were wrong, were erroneous. And so, based on the subsequent events, the issues as to whether the trial court's conclusions that there was fraudulent conduct are mooted, because it makes no difference, because there's no debt and ESF can't recover anything from the McKennas. The Van Scott Court, again citing the Munsingware case from the United States Supreme Court, said because it's mooted and the appellate court does not issue advisory opinions and is not going to issue an opinion on an issue which makes no difference, as in this case, it's the duty to vacate the lower court judgment so it doesn't have any preclusive effect or any harmful effect upon the appellants, the McKennas in this case. The trial would have been totally different if the if there was a trial. I don't believe there would have been a trial, but it would have been, the evidence was there was no debt, as opposed to there's this $300,000 debt and these estate planning measures that the McKennas took were deemed to be fraudulent to hinder, delay, or defraud. So that's, and the exception that is voluntary action set forth in the Van Scott case is just not applicable. McKennas didn't do anything voluntarily. They didn't voluntarily have the judgment entered against them.
Can I ask you, Mr. Cohen, I'll maybe steal some of Mr. Alona's wind here out of his sails. They respond or argue that the Double Oak construction case is an exception and makes this not moot because Double Oak says a judgment is not required. Could you respond to that?
Well, yeah, a judgment is not required. A debt's required. And so when you're looking at the act, in 2008, while the case was pending, well, there was an allegation there was a debt. There was an allegation the McKennas were a debtor and ESF was a creditor. And that allegation, after trial, there was a judgment, which was ultimately reversed. So there actually was, when it actually came to fruition, a debt and a debtor-creditor relationship. Actually, there wasn't a debtor-creditor relationship because the judgment was reversed. So you don't need a judgment, but you need ultimately to have an actual debt, and that doesn't exist in this case.
If I can ask you, Mr. Cohen, I know I fully understand your argument on mootness, and from your position, we don't even have to get to your other arguments. Yes. If we rule on mootness. Just for argument's sake here, I want to make sure I understand the other arguments that you're making. With respect to the halftime motion, the motion for, I guess it was a judgment or a motion to dismiss since it was a bench trial, you seem to be, and I understand the argument, that there was evidence that the liens exceeded the value, therefore there was nothing, etc. You seem to be relying on your own evidence, and I just want to make sure I understand the facts. Don't we have to look at the evidence that existed after the plaintiff's case, and what evidence was that?
There wasn't any evidence. In the plaintiff's case, they called Mr. McKenna and Mrs. McKenna as witnesses, and both of them testified as to what the debt was. Mr. McKenna, as owner of the residence, testified as to the value on October 27, 2008. Testified with his stipulation, he was over 60 years old, so he had the homestead exemption. And there was no evidence whatsoever, competent evidence, as to what the value of the Parker property was on October 27, 2008. The appraisal was part of the defendant's case. It wasn't in the plaintiff's case. So the argument at the halftime motion was there's no evidence to support that there's even an asset that can be transferred under the definitional section of the Fraudulent Transfer Act.
So the McKenna's testified on the plaintiff's case here, and so that they testified the liens exceeded the value.
The amount of the lien was testified in his exhibits and his stipulated what the liens were in the plaintiff's case.
Okay, that's what I was trying to understand.
In the plaintiff's case, that evidence came out.
All right, and then the last thing, and I know I'm monopolizing your time here, the last question I want to ask to make sure I understand your argument. You've raised an indispensable party argument here, and I guess I don't understand how that wasn't waived. I mean, the first time it comes up is in post-trial motions, as I recall.
Well, it's not really in a defense. ESF has to bring in indispensable parties. And in this case, this is different than a typical corporate case that you don't bring in the shareholders. Here, after a valid transfer was a conveyance in October of 2008, various other parties purchased interests in the entity. The law is clear that until a conveyance is voided, it's good. So they relied upon this conveyance, and they, the Schmitz, Mishler, Johnson, took valuable interest. And if you take away the property, which was the basis of their investment, without them having a right to at least get their investment back, you're depriving them of due process.
But they know that there's an issue when the case was filed. I mean, it's troubling to say you can wait for the adverse judgment and then say, wait a minute, you had a joint indispensable party, so the judgment's void. That seems to be what happened here.
But they weren't served. They weren't on notice.
You could make a motion to dismiss for failure to join indispensable parties. That's the normal course when someone feels there wasn't an indispensable party wasn't joined.
I believe it's the plaintiffs, for constitutional due process reasons, to join the indispensable parties, as opposed to the defendant's obligation to say the indispensable parties. So that if the defendant is going to be prejudiced because of the lack of a joint of indispensable parties, maybe the defendant has an obligation. Here's these three individuals who were prejudiced by the court's order not taking into account their investments.
Now, why weren't they adequately represented by your clients? They're all relatives or closely
associated. It's not an obligation, Your Honor.
But that is a defense or an indispensable party claim. If they're adequately represented, they're not indispensable. That's the law. So why were they not adequately represented? What did your clients not do that they would have done?
Because it didn't affect my clients per se. It affected these indispensable parties.
And you have standing to raise their claims based upon the argument you've just made?
Excuse me?
And you have standing to raise their claims based upon the argument you've just made that you have no obligation to do anything for them?
I think we have standing because those third parties may come after my client based upon what's happened in this case. And I believe in that case we have standing because we could be injured. I'd like to reserve, unless there's other questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my
time.
Thank
you, Mr. Cota. Thank you for your patience. You've got about 2 minutes and 19 seconds.
May it please the court, my name is Richard Gabriel Olona. My number is 17940. I represent Equity Secured Funds, Inc. Equity Secured Funds has a great name, but it actually is owned by Pat Irving 100%. It's a small, closely held company. Appellants make an assertion that I think is critical to their mootness argument, and that is that the existence and validity of the monetary judgments are essential to support the claim under CUFTA. But as the court has noted, the Double Oak Construction case very clearly says that there is no lien requirement. They dispensed with it, that they focus instead on the debtor's intent to frustrate the creditor once the claim is known. And the statement is very clear that there is a lien is not necessary before there is an actionable wrong under CUFTA. It makes the transfers unlawful as against creditors without a lien, and even as against creditors without a judgment.
But there, at least in Double Oak, there's a potential judgment. I mean, here what we essentially have is judgment for the McKenna's, and
well,
the end of it.
I have to respectfully ask the court to review the trial court's and the Court of Appeals prior judgment, because the court's been misinformed. There were two claims that were upheld in the prior case, the 2007 case. One was an unjust enrichment claim against McKenna Development Company. The other was for civil theft against all of the defendants, including Mr. McKenna and his wife. And that is the claim which ordered the return of the lots.
One of those claims, one claim was for $1, if I remember, correct?
The enrichment claim was for $1.
Right, and the other was for return of property with no monetary judgment at all.
The return of the property, no corresponding monetary judgment. And what's interesting is that there's no doubt at the time that this transfer took place that ESF was indeed a creditor. The courts, I'm sorry, a creditor is defined as under the CUFTA. A creditor is a person who has a claim, a right to payment, whether or not the right is reduced to judgment, liquidated, unliquidated, etc. And it includes legal and equitable claims as well. So what happened in this case, Your Honor, was that Mr. McKenna, without authority, executed quitclaim deeds purporting to be an officer of Equity Secured Funds. He wasn't. He filed those, and it took this action to get those back. So there was no question that at the time, October of 2008, when they made these transfers, they were under the gun. And the statute goes further. CRS 388105 states that in determining actual intent, the consideration may be given to whether or not the debtor had been sued or threatened with suit. This court in this case took time to explain its reasoning. They stated that this transfers was not made in response to anything other than being sued. The statement was that the transfer was made after McKenna had been sued because suit was filed in 07 and pending and set for trial at the time of the transfers. McKenna testified that the transfer to the family trust was done just in case he died during knee surgery. However, the court finds it's more likely that the transfer was made just in case he suffered an adverse verdict in the 2000 litigation. For that reason, Your Honor, since the monetary judgments that were entered, ultimately, they did not form the basis of the fraudulent transfer action in the first place, then the reversal of those monetary judgments does not change the nature of the fraudulent transfers at the time they were made. Nothing has happened. Let's talk about Van Schaap, because Van Schaap was the suit between the Van Schaaps and the Fullenwriters. And in that case, Fullenwriter was ordered to dissolve the company. He filed an appeal objecting to that, but that during the time of the appeal, he voluntarily dissolved it. That's a moot appeal. This is not a moot appeal. In fact, this appeal was brought to challenge the failure to dismiss at the close of plaintiff's case. And this appeal was brought to challenge whether or not there were indispensable parties that were not joined. Those issues still exist. Those aren't moot.
Let me drill down on this, Mr. Lona, because I'm confused. I think we agree. CUFTA requires you to have a claim. We all agree with that, right? The statute says that. 388-1092, unvoidable transfers, expressly refers to a claim. And maybe where I'm having some difficulty with your argument is I understand the law. A claim is an enforceable right to payment. I mean, you mentioned equity, but I don't think the cases support that. And I'm just throwing what I understand and push back on me here if I have it wrong.
I will, you know, please. Because the civil theft statute, which was ultimately upheld, does allow the parties to seek treble damages for their claim. The fact of the matter was is that the properties were in a state that they could be transferred back.
Treble damages of what? Is it $3? I can't remember which claim was the $1. Is that the civil theft claim?
Again, Your Honor, there were claims made that were ultimately overturned. Those claims did exist at the time these transfers were made.
But they don't exist now. Let's look at the injunction, for example, in this specific case. What the injunction expresses said it survived until the judgment was satisfied, as I recall.
Right.
Well, there's no judgment. Isn't the judgment effectively satisfied when the Court of Appeals overturns it?
Let me break that down, because please. I think there's two different parts to this. The court in the trial court in this case said two things. They're going to void the transfers as fraudulent, both of them, one of the house and one of the park of property. That's one part of the judgment. Those are stricken and removed. The second part of that judgment was, and I'm going to put on a restriction that you cannot transfer further until these things are paid. My argument is that if that part of it is satisfied,
then they're free to now transfer the property.
That's the point. That's their argument. I mean, it's your, what you just said, I totally agree with. It's void until the judgment is paid. There's no judgment anymore, so their position is the avoidance goes away.
But, Your Honor, the fraudulent transfer took place at a time where there was a claim that exists. The transfer was fraudulent then. It's not any less fraudulent now because the Court of Appeals decided that there was insufficient evidence to support certain of the monetary claims. The claim still existed at the time. The jury certainly found that there was $360,000 that should have been paid back to to Equity Secured Funds. Those claims were viable, they were alive, and at the time these transfers were made, again, back to the intent of the transferor.
Well, and Mr. Luna, excuse me for interrupting. I mean, you have a very powerful claim on the intent and the conduct. I get it. But what I'm having trouble is you're asking us to ignore the Court of Appeals ruling that said the judgment was invalid. They overturned it. I understand you had a judgment at the time, but the Court of Appeals says...
It was only overturned, Your Honor. It was only part of the...
$335,000 worth or something of the $335,000 of the judgment, which is really what was being secured here, is overturned. What you're left with was $1 and returned the property, which is not a monetary judgment. What exactly are the whole point here is you can't... A party can't transfer away property to avoid a collection. We have none of that anymore.
I think, Your Honor...
And push back. I'm giving...
I understand, Your Honor. I respectfully disagree because I believe that the fraudulent transfer statute is based solely on what was the intent. The fact that this judgment, had it been reduced, had it been eliminated entirely, in my opinion, doesn't affect the nature of what happened here.
And that's Romano,
an intentional effort to thwart at the time they made the transfers.
Mr. Romano, may I ask you a hypothetical, please?
Yes, sir.
Let us assume that the entire judgment had been vacated by the prior division, and thus all of that had been overturned. Are you saying that you would still have a viable appeal? And if so, what would your remedy be?
I don't know whether I'd have a viable appeal because I wouldn't be the one appealing, but my argument would be that it's the same answer either way, whether or not that judgment was overturned in its entirety or not, because this case was about a fraudulent transfer made by these defendants.
I understand, I think the point that Judge Gabriel was trying to make is that there's a connection between the two. And if the former goes away, and my hypothetical is the former goes completely away, let's assume the prior division reversed everything. I understand that's not what happened, but let's assume that's what it did do. Would you still have a fraudulent conveyance claim, and if so, what would your remedy be?
I believe you do. You do have a fraudulent transfer claim because I don't think they are tied. I think Double Oak is very strong about that. It says there is no requirement of a judgment to prove a fraudulent transfer. And in this case, there was an overwhelming proof. There were 9 badges of fraud. I think there's only 11 of them that are cited by the statute. But 9 out of the 11 were proved in this case to show that this transfer was not right.
I understand that. What's your remedy?
I believe the remedy is to keep the judgment, the trial court's judgment, as it is. I think that's the sound reason here, because the judgment said this transfer was fraudulent, and until they're satisfied, they cannot transfer again. Now that they claim it's satisfied, I think they have the ability to go and transfer. But the property is where it should be. The property is with Ed McKenna and Patty McKenna, and not these false entities that they created for the purpose of thwarting a creditor. And we're not the only creditor. There were other creditors at the time. This was a chase against several banks. I mean, this was a very difficult thing to prove. I think the courts have recognized a fraudulent transfer is a difficult thing, and for that reason, they do look at these badges of fraud. And there was 9 of them here. I think the court went in great depth
I think the judge did a very good job of separating the facts. And for that reason, we just don't believe that the mootness issue applies in this case. I'm almost out of time. I do want to address very quickly the other issues. The issue on the assets in CUFTA, that was raised, I think, three or four different times and addressed each time by the trial court. The argument that there was no evidence relating to the value during the plaintiff's case is simply wrong. Matter of fact, most of the good evidence came from Ed McKenna and his wife. They not only provided testimony as to the value, but the evidence showed that 3 months before they did this transfer of the Parker property to the Hilltop Partners, the McKennas themselves submitted a sworn statement to a bank stating that that property was worth $4 million. They did it twice as well earlier, once at $3.5 million, once at $3. Now they want to propose it's $2.1. I don't know what happened to that market, but they went from $4 million to $2 million in 3 months. We think that was very telling, and I think it went to the credibility as well, because you have a sworn statement submitted to banks. Same thing with the residents. The residents, just before this same exact 3 months before they make these transfers, Ed McKenna himself filed a sworn statement that the property was worth $800,000. So to say that there was no evidence at all is just wrong. What was interesting is that they did produce an expert witness that testified that the property was only worth this, the Parker property, and hence was not an asset, but the court didn't find him credible. The court said, look, what are you doing? You're using this average column for everything except when you come to the cap rate. And if you know anything about appraisal, the cap rate is critical, and it has to be applied correctly. And the court found that Mr. Katsouros' appraisal was self-serving, and that it appeared from the judge. And the judge did take the time. He didn't miss this. He took the time to determine that there was, in fact, a value and assets. Lastly, relating to the indispensable parties, just have to point out that interest alone doesn't do it. And these shareholders or these unit holders would have to show that they had some individualized interest in the litigation that wasn't protected. Number one, there is no individualized interest that's been identified. It's never been argued. It's never been proposed. But in fact, there was a very strong representation in this case on behalf of the LLC. And I've listed 13 things that this attorney did. I think they were very well represented by Mr. Cohen. They did. They made it a very difficult case for us. And they filed motions. They hired experts. They did discovery. They did depositions. They did disclosures of expert disclosures. They obtained a confidentiality order. They appeared at trial vigorously. At the end, they submitted a 64-page exhibit showing why they should win a motion to dismiss. They submitted a bill of costs. They submitted proposed findings. They moved for post-trial relief. And as a matter of fact, they did everything possible. I don't believe there is anything else that could have been contributed by the third parties. And for that reason, they're not indispensable. And I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Olona. Mr. Cohen, I think you had 2 minutes and 19 seconds left.
Thank you. The Fraudulent Transfer Act is to prevent a debtor from avoiding collection, as Judge Gabriel stated. It talks about looking at claims, inchoate claims. Until that claim is actually litigated, you don't know whether the claim is good or not. So a purported debtor, if the claim is ultimately determined to be valid, could, while it's inchoate, violate the statute. In this case, there's no debtor-creditor relationship. There's no debt. The two judgments that remained, one was against the LLC, not against the McKennas. So it's for $1. The ESF does not have a claim to recover that $1 from the McKennas. And clearly, no one would transfer property to avoid a $1 claim. The second one, the civil theft, there are no damages. There's no, the only claim is the entity is to return four lots which were not involved in this case. The judge, trial judge, made no reference to the other, the $1 judgment or the civil theft return of the lots judgment in his order. He was referring to the four monetary judgments. What should have happened in this case is it should have been, trial should have been stayed until the Court of Appeals ruled, and if when once this court ruled, there was no debt, the trial would have gone away. And even the facts would have been different. The whole trial would have been different. The credibility would have been different. McKenna's testified, we didn't believe we owed any money to ESF. We did this for estate planning purposes. And if the fact was they did not owe any money, and that was the right result, the result would have been different below. And that's why the judgment should be vacated.
Thank you, Mr. Cohen. The court would like to thank both counsel for your briefs and excellent arguments that we heard today. And if I may personally say, I also appreciate very much the professionalism and civility that I saw from both of you. I know this was a contested, very difficult and contested case. You both know we see a lot of incivility out there among lawyers, and the fact that you put that stuff behind and acted as professionals and civil means a lot to the court, and we thank you both for it. The case will stand submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course. Counsel.